in 3 days. They completely lose track of time. When they leave Galadriel's realm or Rivendell and they try and describe what it was like, they can't put it in words. There's something ineffable about it, right? So the very kind of enchantment that Tolkien is trying to pull off over us is modeled in the story, right? And Tolkien thought that was crucial, right? That by watching this happen to Frodo in the story, it's more likely than it happened to us as the reader at the same time, right? And this is, again, a kind of Barfieldian theme that Tolkien is using to transmute his philosophy into the story, ultimately. So Barfield's, it's precisely, in the philosophy that he's trying to incorporate into the story is the same philosophy that's guiding the incorporation, right? So the philosophy that's guiding this process is also the philosophy that's being incorporated. It's this Neoplatonic idea that there are these forms, these ideas, these underlying unities, right, that we need to get a better grasp on. That's what he's trying to accomplish. Aristotle puts it this way, in both the Poetics and the Rhetoric, Aristotle says that the construction of the right metaphors is the work of genius. So he thinks that's the most important thing we can do, really, in our literature, is to create these proper right metaphors. And for this reason, Aristotle says that poetry is more philosophical than history, right? Because by using right metaphors, it actually enables us to become more philosophical. It gets us into touch with reality. When Aristotle talks about poetry imitating nature, it's very important that the nature that it's imitating is not a kind of purely physical, mechanical kind of nature that the prosaic mind would look at, but a nature that's unified, that's holistic, that's filled with meaning and purpose, right? That's the kind of nature that poetry is supposed to imitate. Okay, so that brings me to my final thesis, which is the uncanny influence. So I think that it's interesting that Tolkien, in his work, in many ways, I think, anticipates and foreshadows a number of developments of the Western world since he wrote the things in the 30s and 40s. So, for instance, the disillusionment with science and technology and progress. When he's writing these things in the 30s and 40s, everybody believed totally in science, progress, and technology, and so there were no doubts about that. The ecological movement, the greening of our culture, this was largely new since Tolkien. New Age spirituality, interest in pagan practices and so on, magic and whatnot, the growth of more traditional, more fundamentalist kinds of religion, the rise of fantasy itself as a major literary genre, the rejection of bourgeois conformity and the desire for escape into the world of imagination, typified by the hippies and other sort of counterculture movements of the 60s, and even the collapse of the totalitarian regimes of Nazism and communism. All these things, in a way, are foreshadowed in The Lord of the Rings when you step back and think about it. And that's remarkable, I think. And it suggests that there's only three or four possibilities. One is just a sheer coincidence. Just Tolkien happened to be, got to get all these things right in some sense. He was some kind of genius who was able to foresee exactly where the future was going, incorporate that into his work. Or he actually caused some of these things to happen, at least to some extent. And I'm sort of pumping for third one, that actually a lot of these things resulted. And, you know, there's some evidence for this. So the Lord of the Rings was a favorite book by the LSD guru, Timothy Lear. A lot of the hippies would show up at Tolkien's house in Oxford, and he didn't like them, actually, but they were definitely attracted to him in various ways. There was even a group called the Environmental Liberation Front that blew up some houses in Indiana that was inspired by Tolkien. So there were the environmental movements that were inspired by Tolkien as well. So Tolkien, as I said earlier, when he was writing the mid-20th century, you know, scientific materialism was the dominant view. Marxism and logical positivism dominated philosophy. You couldn't do the kind of metaphysics that he was talking about in academia. And all that's changed, really. Of course, as you know, The Lord of the Rings has sold, I think, 150 million copies now, influenced through the movies. I might say close just talking about the movies, actually. So I don't want to talk about the Hobbit movies because they're terrible. But the three original Peter Jackson movies, I think, personally, I think they're pretty good, actually. And when you look at Peter Jackson's history, you think, how's that possible they're any good? Because he didn't show any sign of being the kind of person who could produce these sort of movies. And my theory is that they're as good as they are, again, because Tolkien enchanted Peter Jackson, right? That the quality of the work sort of overwhelmed his own limitations in some ways and produced a reasonably good book as a result. So having pumped all this, I mean, I do think there's sort of a worrying fact here that if I'm right, you know, Tolkien's been incredibly influential, and maybe there's some reason to worry about this to some extent. I mean, I think when Tolkien and Lewis were writing, they thought that if people became more pagan, that would actually be a good thing because paganism was a step above the kind of materialism that was prominent in their day. But now I'm not so sure. Right now I'm a little worried that paganism is maybe not a good thing. There could be some negative influences here as well. But I'll just leave it at that and please, hopefully we've got some time for some questions and discussions. So, okay, thanks.
Open the floor to any questions you guys have. I'm for Dr. Kunz. So.
Yeah, I'll go and take questions if you'd like. Yes, sir.
Okay. So I would just like to clarify, does Tolkien believe in fate?
In fate? Yeah, so I think that he believed, much as Augustine and Aquinas did, that there is a kind of divine plan behind the events of the world. And, of course, this raises an ancient problem, right? Which is how you reconcile that with personal freedom and responsibility. And it's pretty clear that Tolkien thought that somehow they could be made compatible. And in a way, the point of the stories is to convince us that that's so, right? So that we can sort of, as we read the story and we think, okay, is Sam freely choosing to spare Gollum? Yeah. Is it really important that you do that for the sake of this larger story? Yeah. So somehow or other, it's both fate and freedom at the same time.
Right. Balance of both.
Yeah, or a synthesis of both or something. Yeah, I think ultimately he'd want to say that they aren't really incompatible with each other. They seem like they're in conflict, but they aren't really. But I admittedly, that's a tough problem. I'm not sure, I'm not claiming that I have an easy solution to that myself. But I think, I actually use Tolkien quite a bit for this sort of thing because I do think that the relationship between God and us and the world bears an interesting analogy to the relationship between someone like Tolkien and the world of Middle Earth, right? So when people say, you know, how can God allow bad things to happen? I think, well, why did Tolkien write Sauron in the story, right? Well, you know, it made a better story, right? it doesn't make Tolkien a bad person because he's got bad characters in the story, right? And so in some similar way, it doesn't make God bad that he creates creatures that misuse their free will in various ways.
So in your exploration of the thesis on its influence on the modern world,
yeah.
Did you have an aha moment that set off your exploration into it, or how did that come about in your development?
Yeah, I guess I was reading other people. I mean, Shippey, let's see, what's Shippey's first name? He took over Oxford, the chair at Oxford that Tolkien had, and wrote a book called Tolkien, the Author of the Century, which I really liked. It was back in the 80s, I think. He has a chapter where he sort of makes some of these points that I mentioned in the lecture. And so that definitely impressed me. And I've been thinking about it ever since, really, that, I mean, certainly the world of literature is totally different as a result of Tolkien, right? There's no question about that. I remember seeing The Hobbit back when I was a teenager in the 70s, and what's that? That's really weird. And there was like nothing, hardly anything remotely like that. I mean, the sci-fi of the day was very, very different, right, as you know. So he's changed literature in lots of profound ways, but I think it's also changed the whole culture in lots of ways, right? You all are too young to remember this, really, right? But there was a day when people thought that the most important thing was just more science, more technology, more conquest of nature, that's obviously the upward path of everything, and that there was never any cost to it, right? There was never any worry, reason to have any qualms about it. And that was certainly the dominant view when Tolkien's writing this stuff. So when he's talking about I mean, in his essay on the fairy tales, he sort of defends people who charge his mythopoeia as being a kind of escapist literature. And he says, well, you know, who's against escape? Prison guards, right? it's this kind of technological, pragmatistic mindset that says, you know, just get back to work and make more widgets, right? That sees a danger in what Tolkien's trying to do. So he really did see what he's doing as revolutionary in some sense, kind of changing our consciousness in this deep way. So I think he was aware of it to some extent. Miss.
What influenced his way of thinking? So he
was born, he was raised Catholic. His mother was actually a convert to Catholicism. And his father had died when he was young, and his mother converted to Catholicism. And that created all kinds of problems because the rest of her family basically disowned them. And so his father dead, the family disowned them. They were really poor for quite a while. He was able to get a scholarship to get to King Edward School and then eventually to Oxford. His mother died pretty young as well, partly because of all the stress of this family conflict and the poverty and so on. So he sort of thought of his mother as something of a martyr, I guess, for her faith. So he was always very serious about his own Catholic faith, and so as he said in one of his letters, his works are profoundly Catholic works. Again, not in the sense that, I mean, you can certainly do this. You can point to things like the Lembas wafers and say that's sort of like the Eucharist, right? And the more you rely on it, the more powerful it becomes. So, and you can think about all the different female characters as something like Virgin Mary-like figures in some ways. But I think he would think that was a very superficial way of thinking about it, that the Catholicism was actually deeper than that in his works. So, yes, Mr. Mack.
You said, by trade, you were a logistician, is that
right? Logician, yeah.
Do you feel any sense of conflict between your appreciation for pure logical reasoning and your evident appreciation for like the emotional truth sought by myth, metaphor, poetic truth?
Yeah, I mean it's a little odd, but I don't really think it's a conflict, right? I think I see it more of this way that in our hyper specialized world, right? Or like even in philosophy, you're sort of encouraged to become just a logician or just an epistemologist or whatever. That can be very distorting, right? Because, you know, it's the old, you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail kind of a phenomenon, right? If you're a logician, suddenly everything becomes a logic problem, right, that you have to solve in a kind of formal way. And I guess I've always thought early on that I wanted to resist that. G.K. Chesterton, another of my favorite thinkers, has a great line. If a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. So, and it's absolutely right when you think about it, right? It's exactly right. So we should actually try to do lots of things badly, right? Because they're good. And not just do that one thing that we do well. Again, our whole culture pushes us in the other direction. Right? I see this with all my with my kids, with their parents of their friends, right? And even my kids to some extent. It's like, find that one thing your kid does and just do that all the time. Push them in that direction. And the danger is that you're distorting human nature, right? I mean, all the ancient Greek philosophers were worried about this. Roman philosophers, too. They thought, you know, the ideal human being is a farmer, they thought, because they thought farmers were well-rounded because you had to do botany and economics and zoology and meteorology. And you had to do all these different things, right? You aren't just tightening the bolt on the assembly line, right, all day. So I think, you know, this is true in the intellectual life, too. And this is the sort of thing that I like about Barfield, is this idea of, we have to try to find that balance. Otherwise there's a danger of sort of insanity, right, of becoming so hyper-specialized in your thinking, right? So I love logic. I'm pretty good at it, so I keep doing it. But I think... there's a danger in overemphasizing, overestimating its importance, right? Like Bertrand Russell, when they first discovered the new logic in the early 20th century. And the thought was, we're going to clean up all the philosophy. Philosophy professors go away because we'll solve everything by using these new logical tools. And of course, that didn't work, right? Because the deep problems we face are not just logic, are not logical problems, actually. They're other things. And so having a grounding in literature, poetry, I think, is really, really important. Really important. So, yes, sir?
So you described Tolkien as like Platonist, but in the way you described his belief on poetry, it seems sort of counter to like Platonic like mimesis.
Yeah.
So how do you reconcile that?
Yeah. So that's a really interesting problem, right? So especially if you read The Republic, right? He just bashes Homer all the time, right? And then at the very end, especially, it's like poetry is this terrible thing, and it's third-rate philosophy at best, and so on. But I mean, I think you just have to take a lot of that with a grain of salt, right? So, I mean, Plato himself, he's not the most straightforward philosopher, really. He's not always telling you exactly what he thinks, I don't think, right? He's maybe being deliberately provocative at times, right? It's true, I think, that in his... Of course, you have to set yourself back in his context, where in his context, Homer was everything, right? I mean, Homer was you know, all of education was basically Homer, right? And Homer was held up as the model of source of all knowledge and thought and wisdom, right? And so he had to knock Homer down a few pegs in order to make room for Platonic philosophy. Whereas if Plato were here today, I think he would look at the opposite and say, you guys don't do any poetry at all. This is terrible, right? And so he would probably be writing Republic about how wonderful poetry was. How, you know, you got to get away from engineering and physics and so on. So I think it's, you know, I don't know. I'm guessing, right? But you raise an interesting point, all right. The other thing I'd say, just to back up my idea, I guess, a little bit, is that there's something really weird about the fact, right, that in the same book that he does all that Homer bashing, he ends it with a myth, right? And it's pure literary creation on his part, right? So he can't really mean it, right? He said earlier that, what he said about poetry earlier, I think. You have to sort of read between the lines here a bit, I think. Yeah. Yes, sir?
I wonder if you could say on how Tolkien writes the Lord of the Rings and also how he kind of contrasts that with how he writes the Silmarillion, because I know I'm reading Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I'm going to read the Silmarillion now.
Yeah.
It's like really different.
Really different, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, here, I think this is the basic difference, is that when you read Lord of the Rings, you see all this stuff in the distance. It's kind of hazy distance, right, of Luthien and, you know, who are these guys and all this stuff and the Lost Islands, what's that, you know? And you don't know what they are, but it creates a tremendous verisimilitude, right? It's like you've been plopped into a world that's a real world, three-dimensional, four-dimensional world, right? And the very fact that you don't get to know all that is kind of an important part of the enjoyment of being immersed in it. Then you get to the Silmarillion, and you're like all the way back there. There's nothing behind it, right? Here's the creation story, right? Here's the ultimate parameters. And so now there are no hazy horizons anymore, right? You're getting all the nitty-gritty details. And so it's a different kind of experience, a totally different kind of experience. It's definitely not as universally appealing. For those of us who are total Tolkien fanatics, it's still interesting, right? So you want to know, yeah, I really want to know who Luthien was and how this happened. But then, the experience of it isn't quite the same as when you just get these little hints and wisps of her and other kind of figures in the Lord of the Rings. So that's my way of thinking about it. Now, in terms of the actual writing, I mean, it's the other way around, right? He first creates something like the Silmarillion. He had to create the world in all of its detail and complexity, and then he could write The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings by setting a story within that world that he created. And in fact, in his case, it's even more intricate than that, because before he creates the world, he creates the languages, right? And so he's the only author, I think, in history, as far as I know, who starts out creating new languages, right? And then finds he has to create a world in order to make the language complete. And then after you create the world, he says, "Let's put some stories in this world." So it's very different from any other person's approach to literature that I know of, and it's created this unique result. I mean, probably no one else will ever do it again, but I'm glad he did. Right? I'm glad it didn't just get lost entirely, and that it ended up in the public domain. But yeah, it's a really interesting point. Yes, please.
Just
How does a character like Tom Bombadil fit into Tolkien philosophy?
I knew he was going to come up at some point. Everybody loves Tom Bombadil. I do too. So it's interesting. So Bombadil was actually a character that shows up in some poetry that he writes really early on. I think even as a student in secondary school, he's writing little stories about Tom Bombadil. I don't actually know if there's any further background behind that. But I think what happened was he's writing Lord of the Rings, and he just thinks, yeah, this really cool little Tom Bombadil character in this poem, so I'm just going to throw him in here. And so it's one case where, as far as I know, there's nothing in the Silmarillion or the rest of the stuff that locates him anywhere. So he's an anomaly in the Lord of the Rings. So you might say, well, why did he do that? I mean, doesn't that in a way contradict his whole sub-creation idea, which is you create this completely logically coherent universe, right, and then you put the story inside of it. Tom Bombadil seems to be a contradiction of that philosophy. So my explanation goes something like this. That, well, yes, but the real world has got anomalies in it, right? And so if he created a world that was totally logical and everything made sense, that wouldn't seem real, right? So he had to throw in some of these odd characters like Tom Bombadil, and you think, where does that fit in? Is he an elf or what? You know, precisely because that's part of the world, right? We find out there's dark matter out there. What the hell is that? You know, so if it all made sense, it somehow wouldn't work, right? That's my explanation. I don't know. Maybe he just couldn't resist the temptation of putting him in there because he's kind of this cool character, right? I don't know. Further answer that. Yeah.
Thank you. I think that this ties back to that question. Because Tom seems to be this one character that is unaffected by the ring. Like, he pulls it and, like, has no effect on him. And I wonder, what is the metaphysical meaning of the ring itself? And I think that's important.
Yeah, that's really good. So, right, so what's the point of the ring itself? There is, of course, a ring in Plato's Republic, the Ring of Gyges, that turns you invisible as well. Tolkien, I'm sure, would not like me to bring this up, but I will anyway, because it seems like it's really parallel, because in the Ring of Gyges story, the man who discovers the ring uses it to seduce the king's wife, kill the king, become the new king, and so on, because by being invisible, he escapes from all moral restraints. He can't be punished. His reputation can't be affected because he can do things secretly with the ring. And obviously that's what happens with the ring in the story too, at least with Gollum and with other characters, right? They end up finding themselves freed from moral constraints. And then, of course, the whole point in the Republic is, could we find a person, can we make a person or build a person such that they won't misuse the ring, right? Such that they will be able to resist the temptation because of their own internal goodness, their own orientation toward goodness. And of course the answer is, well, sort of, yes, right? Sam and Frodo, at least to some extent, right, are able to, and even Bilbo, maybe even more Bilbo, are able to use the ring without being corrupted by the power that it represents, right? I mean, it's clearly, it does seem to me to represent technological power in some sense, right? And you know, again, if I said something like it like represents the atom bomb or something, Tolkien would blow his top and say, that's exactly the kind of allegory I don't want you to do. But in a way it does, right? Because it does represent the kinds of things that the atom bomb represents, which is the ability of human ingenuity to give us new kinds of power that we would otherwise wouldn't have, and the danger that produces, right, and how the wise person sometimes just throws it into the crack of doom, right, says we're not going to go there, right? So, I mean, that has lots of applications, because you might say AI or social media, throw those into the crack of doom too, right, because they're creating their technological solutions to problems that aren't really there, right, that are potentially destructive, right? So that's one of the things that I think that I think a work. This is where a myth is really a myth and not an allegory. It has open-ended applications. Right? It's not just okay. We learned something about the bomb. It's rather, no, we learned something deep about human power and technology and so on.
We have time for two more questions.
Okay.
I heard you talk about providence and how Gandalf was saying, "Oh, maybe there's something else working behind the scenes." I think that was kind of like a sly reference by Tolkien to himself, maybe? Like,
well, yeah, right. So, I mean, he calls what he does sub-creation, right? So he definitely recognizes that in creating this kind of world, he's sort of the god of Middle-earth, right? But it's a sub-creation, so he's not literally God, right? And he can't give actual being to his creatures the way God can do. But that's right. I mean, he's the thought is that we can use human literary creativity as a kind of model for understanding God and the relationship between God and the world. And I think that's actually a really fruitful thing to do. Dorothy Sayers actually has a book, Something of the Maker. Idea of the Maker, the image of the Maker. I forget the exact title now, but it's a whole book that's basically trying to derive the doctrine of the Trinity or relate the doctrine of the Trinity to the literary process. I think it's a similar kind of idea, right? That there's something analogous between our creativity and God's creativity. Really good question. Yeah. Okay, who wants to take the very last one? Yes, yeah.
I'm kind of like, I want to make sure I get the question right.
Yeah.
I was really fascinated when you said like the Tolkien uncanny influence in like the culture.
Yeah.
Kind of like how you gave examples of some things that he kind of predicted and kind of it seems to have a. So I guess I had a question where it's like, how deeply do you think his works have impacted the culture, like from when it was released all the way through to like current time?
Yeah.
Or how it like.
Sorry, I don't know why this is ringing. I think it's me. I don't. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry. So it's a good question. I mean, my impression is that Tolkien is continuing to grow in influence, right? And I kept thinking, well, maybe like after the movies would create this kind of flip, and it did. And it did blip, did sort of die down. I thought, okay, maybe that's the end of Tolkien. We'll move on. But I don't think it's happened, right? So I do think. I mean, if pressed, I would say he's really one of the three or four most important writers of all time, right? He's right up there with Homer and Dante and Shakespeare, basically, in terms of his longevity. That would be my guess. And so I think we may not even know yet how big an influence he made, right? And as I say, it's a little worrying. You know, even though I'm basically a Tolkien fan, I might think, yeah, okay, but come on, do I really want the whole world to be completely transformed by Tolkien thinking? I don't know. It can have weird manifestations. Like when I went to college at Michigan State, I found out there was a Tolkien society there. It's like, oh, that's really cool. I'm going to go to the Tolkien society. And I found out there were a bunch of people there who thought they were elves and dwarves and stuff. I was like, oh, wow. that was not what I was looking for, right? I was looking for a kind of a literary discussion or something. So I stayed away from that. So, you know, there are unintended consequences, right? That in any kind of project. And so, you know, I think there are good reasons why God's built such a world that there's only so much any of us can do, right? And eventually we do sort of peter out. So I sort of hope for Tolkien's case that it does reach a more stable level here at some point. All right. Well, thanks very much. A really great discussion.
And thank you guys so much for coming. If you are part of Dr. Trujillo's class, we have a sign-up sheet. And if you're part of, yeah. And thank you guys. And that's all. Thank you, Dr. Trujillo.
My pleasure.
It was really awesome.
Good.